Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Right Club. The first rule of Right Club is you don't talk about Right Club, but we'll make an exception in your case.
Hello, I'm Nicola. Welcome to Right Club, the podcast for writers and readers everywhere. Today I'm joined by Steph, Heather, Linda, Pat and Teresa.
Hello.
Hi.
This week on Right Club, we're discussing writing from within the context of two world wars. We're going to hear more from Pat's work in progress, and we'll be offering her some feedback just the way we do at our Write Club meetings. Heather is going to provide our amuse-bouche, and Linda and Pat are going to tell us what's on their bedside tables. But first, Teresa is going to ask us to
name the novel.
OK, pens poised, everybody. Yeah. Linda's going to get this one.
Oh, good.
The first clue. This novel was enthusiastically received in 1918 when it was first published. It was considered a masterpiece and has become a classic of American literature.
Oh, boy, American.
OK, that perhaps doesn't give you enough information, but moving on to clue two. Set in the 19th century pioneering community of Nebraska, the novel has a strong sense of place and was a departure from the focus on wealthy families typical of American literature at the time. It was a radical aesthetic move for the author to feature lower-class immigrant hired girls. Mm. So, Linda's nearly there.
Hang on!
There's another clue yet.
Oh, right.
Blurting it out.
It's all right. I'll edit it out.
Okay. So, clue three. The novel is told in the first person through the voice of the orphan, Jim Burden, who travels to Nebraska on a train with an immigrant Bohemian family who will become his neighbours. The daughter of the family gives the novel its title.
I can't remember the name. Is it?
Not
it's
a not,
clue.
It's Willa Cather, right?
It is Willa Cather.
Oh, darn. Why can't I remember the name of the novel? It's something about planes.
No, it's got a female name in it. Oh. I'm sure people out there are screaming at their
wireless.
It's My Antonia. By Willa Cather.
For heaven's sake.
The third book in her Pioneer trilogy, O Pioneers and The Song of the Lark, with the other two. And I was interested in this, and I'm reading it. I'm more than halfway through it, and I'm really enjoying it. I've just read the new Barbara Kingsolver novel, and she references My Antonia in that quite frequently, and the main character is called Willa. So that got me interested in it. But it's been very influential. It was filmed for TV in 1995. Emmy Lou Harris wrote a song called My Antonia, a duet that she wrote. So it's been an important part of American cultural life. So,
yeah,
well done, clearly come with it.
Clearly not an important part of my cultural life.
Oh, no.
I've never heard of it.
Yeah, not mine either. Although I have heard of it and I love Willa Cather, but why can't I remember the name My Antonia?
But I'm really enjoying reading it. It's really some nice writing about nature and you know, it's about children growing up in the wilderness and then in a frontier town.
Right.
And,
well, that sounds good. Thank you, Teresa. Right, as I promised, we're going to listen to Pat reading from her work in progress. What's happening to Mark's dastardly murder plans, Pat?
Well, you're about to find out. All that week, Mark agonised over what to do. He formulated a plan. He knew exactly how he could accidentally let the wheelchair go rolling down the hill into the traffic. He thought he could even make it look as though he was trying to save Peter, while actually giving him an extra push. He played it through in his head, over and over again. He would be Mariana's only support. Of course, she'd be very upset at first, but he would be there for her. It would be just like before, just the two of them. The more he thought about that, the more determined he became. And the more he watched Peter gaining strength, managing to speak ever more clearly, the more determined he became. Thursday, the day of Peter's physio session, was another bright day. Mark had prayed for good weather so that they might repeat their visit to Fletcher's. And sure enough, after their appointment, Mariana made the suggestion. "Great idea," enthused Mark. "Just what we need." It was a different driver this week, but Mark had been relieved to see that the cab was the same design as last week's. Some of them, he'd realised, had the ramp at the side, which let the user down straight onto the pavement, and that would have ruined his plan completely. As they turned onto the street where Fletcher's was, he looked ahead anxiously. What if there was no space in front of the cafe? Or there was someone parked behind? Sweat formed on his top lip. But no, it was fine. There would be a clear run down to the main road. He would guide the chair down the ramp at the rear of the vehicle, and as he turned it to pull it backwards up onto the pavement, he would swing it round just a little bit too far, and under the pretext of straightening it up, he would give it a little push that would send it rolling down the hill. As the chair reached the bottom of the ramp, Mark gripped the handles, his hands clammy with sweat, his mouth dry. He was unaware of anything around him, could think of nothing other than what he was about to do. Didn't hear the throaty roar of the low black Subaru that had turned off the main road and was now speeding towards them as he swung Peter round and released the handles. Mariana's scream pierced his consciousness, and he was suddenly aware of the car, of Peter in its path. Instinctively, he grabbed at the handles to pull him back, but the chair's momentum carried them both forward. He could hear the car's engine coming ever closer, and Mariana sobbing, "Peter! Peter, help him, please!" Clenching his jaw with the effort, he threw his body backwards, gripping the handles and wrenching the chair sideways, clear of the oncoming car. Unable to steady himself, he fell into the road. There was a dull thud as his body made contact with the side of the speeding car and was thrown up and over the bonnet. He lay still. He was aware of sounds, screams, but they seemed to come from far away. Opening his eyes, he found he was looking up at the sky, but there was something wrong. The edges were grey, misty. He felt very tired. He closed his eyes. "Mark, oh, you poor, poor boy!" Forcing himself to open his eyes, he found Mariana kneeling beside him, holding his hand, her face wet with tears. He tried to speak, but couldn't make his mouth move. She kissed her hand and placed it on his lips. His eyes closed. "Oh, my darling, such a good boy."
Well, my word.
I didn't see that coming. I didn't see that coming at all.
What a twist.
That means you didn't do your homework and you didn't read it before today.
I printed it out, though.
Good start. That was a good start. Just an excellent, dramatic, thrilling and chilling scene. I mean, the paragraph which ends with him saying he would give it a little push that would send it rolling down the hills, absolutely
to the main
chilling,
road.
Isn't
yeah.
it?
Mm.
I thought that was great, that paragraph.
Yeah, I still... all of it, really.
I mean, I'm shocked. I'm shocked that he went ahead with it. I'm shocked he had it in him to do it. And then I'm super shocked at the twist at the end.
Yeah. I was quite concerned that he actually could do it, and he did try. Mm-hmm. He did try.
Yeah.
And it kind of changes your view of Mark, although I still feel sympathy for him.
Well, he redeemed himself at the end, didn't he? Mm. Is it the end, though, Pat?
Yes.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
You've
got to the end. Oh, my goodness.
Are you sure you just didn't get bored with writing this?
Did he die? Is he dead? He's dead?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought maybe he was going to be paralysed for life or something.
Well, I suppose it leaves it open-ended, but he closes his eyes. And
what a
powerful, dramatic ending.
Oh, and what a lovely thing to end on, you know, you good boy, which is what he always wanted to hear.
Yes.
What a cost.
Yeah, she believed in him.
Yeah, she did. She's a great character, Mariana. I think that she has... you know, complexity and round the compassion is the keynote of her personality, but she's got all this background and colour, and I think she's a brilliant character.
She is, and I'm hoping now we're going to see this entered in a competition. This short story is
how many words is it now?
Oh, a lot.
I
remember.
But you have, very cleverly, in the best script writing, you've left it open for another series if we really want to go there.
Follow-up. We just talked about this brilliant paragraph where he's planning it out in his mind. I'd like to suggest that you go back to the bit before that and do some more of that, because you started off by saying he agonised over what to do. You formulated a plan. He knew exactly how he could do it. And actually, you've told us he's got the plan, and then you get to this wonderful tension, you know, where he's, God, you know, what if someone's parked in the way? What if the weather's not good? You know, you said it was a different driver and Mark had been relieved. You could actually use the same technique that you've done in that paragraph, sort of saying, you know, he looked out the window and it was a different driver, but it was the same vehicle, you know, and you could use the same kind of tension building, because that is such a tense. You can, you kind of really inside his head, feeling like, you know, what could possibly go wrong? Everything could possibly go wrong. And he's ticking them off one by one. And I think you could do that with the few paragraphs before. I also loved the repetition of the more determined he became. You could even do that three times. You could say he would be Marianne's, sorry, the more he thought about that, the more determined he became. The more he watched Peter gaining strength, the more determined he became. The more clearly Peter spoke, the more determined, you know, I think that's a great, great one. I thought there was maybe a slight point of view issue with the last few paragraphs as well, because we've got everything from in Mark's head, and then there's a dull thud as his body made contact, and actually he would have felt that rather than heard it. So it would be like an explosion.
It didn't feel a bit odd to me,
And then we're back in his head as well, and he's looking at Marianna, and it's lovely.
I thought it was excellent.
Very good.
Cheers. Thank you. I did try very hard to find something to critique, but there wasn't much. But I have picked a couple of things, and you may or may not, you know, want to take them on board, because it's really very difficult. Where you've said, talk about Peter gaining strength, managing to speak ever more clearly, I thought, well, if he can speak, why hasn't he said anything? So it's that how much speech he's got. So just that sort of slightly troubled me. Thursday, the day of Peter's physio session, was another bright day. You could say Thursday was another bright day on the assumption that we know already has this regular Thursday appointment, I think. I'm not sure. But I say really,
yeah,
really
kind of needs to run on in and
tiny things and not that, not significant. And then you have, he could hear the car's engine coming ever closer and Marianna sobbing, Peter, help him, please. Would she be sobbing? You know, I'm thinking maybe it's more screaming that would be going on at that stage. Yeah. Sobbing seems to be a different kind of emotion, not the response to an immediate danger. Yeah. Right. But however, as I say, I had to try very hard to find anything I could pick out. And I think it's brilliant.
Thank you. I had a little trouble hearing him still a little bit about the movement when he lets go of the handles. And then he grabs them again to pull him back. And then they both went forward, and clenching his jaw, he threw his body backwards, gripping the handles. And I wasn't.
Yeah, there was a bit of physics.
I wasn't knowing
strangeness
how,
going
how
on there, wasn't
that
there?
Happened because he grabbed at the handles to pull him back. Okay.
The momentum and kept moving forward.
So the only way he could counter it was
by moving his whole body backwards.
Yeah. Yeah. Throwing himself backwards.
Oh, he'd already been pulled forward. Yeah. So if he was off balance and pulled forward, he couldn't then lever himself backwards. I had a little issue with that as well. But
I think Pat's been practicing this. I think he's got it right.
I almost have.
You've had to work
logistics
it out.
Of it. Positioning.
And what a clever way to end this. Mm. What a clever ending. I could not imagine how this was going to turn out as I read the story.
Yeah.
It was just.
And we were all convinced he was a nice guy, but then it turns out he wasn't at all. But then he redeemed himself. So it was. Thanks very much, Pat. Yeah.
Thank
you. Fantastic. Now we're going over to Heather. So, Heather, what have you got for us this week?
At the meaning of a word. Because we're talking about the war or the wars, Roy asked me, did I know what the name Tommy and where it came from when they're referring to British soldiers? So I'll read this out. In the trenches of World War One, German and French troops would call out over the trenches looking for Tommy when they wanted to talk to a British soldier. You don't hear the term quite so much anymore, but for centuries the nickname reigned supreme. How exactly British troops came to be called Tommy is not quite as complex as why German troops were known as Jerry. In case you were wondering, it's believed to be either because Jerry is short for German or because their helmets look like chamber pots. The British Imperial War Museum says the origin of the literal meaning is disputed. One theory says it originated with the Duke of Wellington, who made it a nickname in 1843. Another says the Imperial War Office established it in 1845, a sort of British John Doe. But the Imperial War Museum found evidence of Tommy more than a century before Wellington supposedly coined it. During the British rule of Jamaica, research found a 1743 letter to the War Office that reported a mutiny among mercenaries there, saying except for those from North America, the Marines and Tommy Atkins behaved splendidly. It was also at this time the red coats worn by British regulars earned them the nickname Thomas Lobster. By 1815, the British War Office was using the name Tommy Atkins as a generic term for sample infantry paperwork. An enlisting soldier, unable to sign his name to his enlistment papers, would make his mark, leaving the name Tommy Atkins spelled out where his real name should have been. Tommy Atkins, and everyone known to history as Tommy Atkins, had a distinguished career in the British military. During the Sepoy Rebellion in India in 1857, a soldier of the 32nd Regiment of Foot remained at his post when most others already fled. He was, of course, overwhelmed and killed. A witness of his heroism later wrote, "His name happened to be Tommy Atkins, and so throughout the mutiny campaign, when a daring deed was done, the doer was said to be a regular Tommy Atkins." The last Tommy, Harry Patch, of World War One era British Army, died in 2009 at the ripe old age of 111.
Wow. Wow. 111. Harry Patch, yeah. Harry Patch wrote a book called The Last Tommy.
Really? Wow. How interesting.
Yeah. And just to finish off, while I was doing the research, I found a poem by Rudyard Kipling.
Oh, very good.
I went into a public house to get a pint of beer. The publican, he up and says, "We serve no redcoats here." The girls behind the bar laughed and giggled, fit to die. I outs into the streets again, and myself says I, "Oh, it's Tommy this and Tommy that, and Tommy go away. But it's thank you, Mr. Atkins, when the band begins to play. The band begins to play, my boys, the band begins to play. Oh, it's thank you, Mr. Atkins, when the band begins to play." I went into a theatre, as sober as could be. They gave a drunk civilian room, but had none for me. They sent me to the gallery or round the music halls, but when it came to fighting, Lord, they shoved me in the stalls. For it's Tommy this, and it's Tommy that, and it's Tommy wait outside, but it's special train for Atkins when the trooper's on the tide. The troopship's on the tide, my boys, the troopship's on the tide. Oh, it's special train for Atkins when the troopship's on the tide. Oh, it's pleased to walk in front, sir, when there's trouble in the wind. You talk of better food for us and schools and fires and all. We'll wait for extra rations if you treat us rationale. Don't mess about the cook room slops, but prove it to our face. The widow's uniform is not the soldier man's disgrace. For it's Tommy this and Tommy that, and chuck him out, the brute. But it's saviour of his country when the guns begin to shoot. And it's Tommy this and Tommy that, and anything you please. And Tommy ain't a blooming fool, you bet that Tommy sees.
Wow.
Ooh. I love that poem.
So, Heather, when was that written?
It was written in 1890.
Oh, OK. So I was interested that even that far back, people were treating soldiers badly.
Yes.
Even, you know, and not wanting them to come into town and go into the theatres and things.
Yeah, they were sort of discriminated against, I suppose. Yeah. And they could be, you know, they could be a handful. They could be quite, you know, absolutely, a pest. And they did chase the women and, you know, get into fights and that sort of thing. So.
And didn't Rudyard Kipling lose a son in the he fought in,
yeah,
the war,
there's that
he?
Film, My Boy Jack, which is very... Okay. Oh, it's dreadful, really, because he pulled strings to get his son, who wasn't really fit to serve, to get him in the front line. He was... I don't know, 17 or 18, and he was leading a platoon and basically died on the first day.
Yes. Oh,
absolute tragedy,
gosh.
but he was determined that he would get in the war.
And no wonder Rudyard Kipling's standing up for the soldiers then. Yeah.
But why would he want his son on the front lines and pulled face again then?
Because I suppose he wanted him to be a hero. He wanted him, you know.
Dodge it, decorum
us. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The First World War, nobody really... The Boer War was the one before that, wasn't it? And perhaps no people didn't remember the horror of it. And,
But the whole of that culture, and particularly the public school educated, but even the working classes as well, they were brought up on this culture of boys' own adventures and heroes. Those were the books that they read about people conquering Africa.
Explorers, adventurers.
Yeah, all of those things. They couldn't wait for a war to come to give them their chance to play those heroic roles, tragically. But that was the conditioning of the culture, really, at that time.
Much like the people in the South in the Civil War, the kids were just, you know, rousing, wanting to go, go and join them.
Okay, so this sounds like a really great point to talk about the writing of the World Wars, and who's got something to share with us?
Well, I found something on the History Channel, funnily enough, on the History Channel website about how World War One changed literature. And it's an article that was written by a lady called Amanda Onion, which is a brilliant name.
Memorable.
And she was saying that, of course, the World War One was initially, it was all going to be over by Christmas. I thought we've all heard that, haven't we? And it then dragged on for 4 years. And there was a whole lot of brutality. You know, it was the first war with trench warfare, advanced weapons, including chemical weapons and the gas, and the horrors of the conflict that altered the world forever. And she's saying that that really affected literature. Virginia Woolf would later write, "Then suddenly, like a chasm in a smooth road, the war came, and it just changed everything." Among the first to document the chasm of the war were the soldiers themselves. At first, of course, you've got idealism as the leaders glorified young soldiers marching off to war. But then, of course, Rupert Brooke, after enlisting in the Royal Navy, wrote a series of sonnets, including The Soldier, which read, "If I should die, think only this of me, there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England," which is kind of romanticising the fact he might die on foreign soil.
Right.
He did actually die of blood poisoning in 1915 after being deployed to the Allied invasion at Gallipoli. The same year, the Canadian doctor, Lieutenant Colonel John McCrae, upon seeing how the red poppies grew in the fields that had been ravaged by bombs and littered with bodies, wrote, "In Flanders Field, in Flanders Fields, the poppies blow, between the crosses row on row that mark our place, and in the sky the larks bravely singing fly, scarce heard amid the guns below." So we're seeing a sort of slight change of tone. It's a little bit less glorified, a little bit more grim.
I love that line about the larks trying to fly above the thunder of the guns. Yeah. That's just amazing. Yeah.
Both Rupert Brooke and John McCrae's work had those kind of patriotic tones to the sacrifices. But as the war went on, we got people like Wilfred Owen, who my dog's named after, Wilfred Owen, and he saw it very much as his duty to reflect the grim reality rather than glorify it. So as Owen would write, again from this article by Amanda Onion, "All a poet today can do is warn. That is why the true poet must be truthful. And in Anthem for the Doomed Youth, Owen describes soldiers who die as cattle and the monstrous anger of the guns." So we're seeing a very big shift from, you know, there is a foreign field that is forever England, and we're now getting some really kind of gritty
truths
coming through. And then we've got Sigrid Sassoon, who wrote about corpses face downward in the sucking mud, wallowed like trodden sandbags loosely filled. That was 1918 he wrote that. It's really, really, you're starting now to see there's no glory in it. These are people that are face down in the mud. Much more realism. From the German side, Erich Maria Remarque also experienced the grim day-to-day life of a soldier, and he wrote All Quiet on the Western Front, and he wrote that in 1929. There were some other war realities. Parades End by Ford Madox Ford, and from the Eastern Front, Dr. Zhivago by Boris Pasternak. Again, the main character describing the grotesque injuries that were inflicted in the battlefields. Hemingway, Farewell to Arms, is among the writer's most autobiographical,
right,
because Hemingway himself served as an ambulance driver and was wounded on the Austro-Italian front, right, where he was sent to a hospital in Milan and fell in love with a nurse. Mm-hmm. So, writers documented the war while it was going on, but also we got lots of reverberations of the war through society. In Virginia Woolf, she'd been a close friend of Rupert Brooke, and she put profound references to the war in her work. So in mm-hmm. Mrs. Dalloway, everyone is deeply affected, and one of the novel's main characters is a veteran with what was called then shell shock, yeah, but we'd now call PTSD, right, post-traumatic stress disorder. Since the World War and the effect that it's had, you've got Woolf's, I'll read this bit to you. The disillusionment that grew out of the war contributed to the emergence of modernism, a genre which broke with traditional ways of writing, discarded romantic views of nature and focused on the interior world of characters. Woolf's novels reflected this emerging tone, as did the works of Joseph Conrad, Heart of Darkness, and James Joyce, Ulysses. T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, considered to be one of the most significant poems of the 20th century, presents a haunting vision of post-war society with the opening lines, "April is the cruelest month, breeding lilacs out of the dead land, mixing memory and desire, stirring dull roots with spring rain." So, as Amanda Runyon says, World War I devastated continents. There were 10 million soldiers and 7 million civilians killed in World War I. So it truly devastated the world. But as she says, writers responded with profound and groundbreaking work as they and the rest of the world grappled with the war's upheaval. Mm-hmm. And as Remarque wrote in All Quiet on the Western Front, all these things that now, while we are still in the war, sink down in us like a stone, after the war shall waken again, and then shall begin the disentanglement of life and death.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a really interesting article in how mm-hmm. that war in particular, you know, the ripples that came out of it mm-hmm. affected yes. the yeah. literature of yeah. the day and the mode of storytelling.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I think yes. it's interesting as well, though, just how much came out from the war yes. compared yeah. with any other war. There was probably a phenomenal amount, and I think we tend to sort of focus on the poetry
mm-hmm.
yeah. to some extent. One of the theories or reasons given for why there was so much that came out was, one was that letters were censored.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Poetry was one way of yeah. conveying
telling the story.
Actually yeah. what was going right. on. I think the written word had more sort of presence in people's consciousness
mm-hmm.
at that
mm-hmm.
time. We're a more visual society now, aren't we?
Mm, I think yes. also, sorry to cut across you, Pat, but yes. also that was probably the first generation of literate soldiers.
Mm. Yes. yes, yes.
Because 20 years before, a lot of people still didn't read and write. So
well, a lot of those didn't, mm. but yeah. there was right. a mixture,
there was
wasn't
more yes. literate, there? Was more literacy yeah. among yeah. the general population.
There would be public school boys alongside yeah. Right. Yeah. Tommy Atkins.
Mm.
And the other one was that there was a lot of downtime in the trenches.
Yeah.
There was yeah. hours and hours just spent
waiting
with yeah. nothing to do. You couldn't yeah. get up and move. You couldn't go anywhere. So the poetry, a lot of the poetry just conveys the sights, sounds, yeah. thoughts mm-hmm. and so yeah. on.
The other thing that occurs to me, we tend to privilege poetry when we're dealing with heightened emotional experience. Mm. It seems to be a mode of writing or a mode of expression that we choose, for example, for weddings and mm-hmm. funerals. So, you know, when people are experiencing horrific mm. events, maybe poetry comes more naturally than prose, I don't know, but there's mm. something of about the emotional intensity of experience mm. which right. which turns us to poetry, I think.
Yeah.
Mm.
Good point.
Yeah. I first became aware of the Rupert Graves and Rupert Brooke, whose poems you've read some of. Well, I read a book called The Rainbow Comes and Goes, which remains one of my favourite autobiographies of all time so far. It's Dinah Cooper, who was a well-to-do society lady, right. and she fell in love with and wanted to marry, but was stopped by her father for a certain period of time, a gentleman called Duff Cooper,
mm-hmm.
who worked in the War Office. They were very much part of the Bloomsbury set, and they were very privileged to, you know, hang out with all of these people. And there's three books, actually. It starts with The Rainbow Comes and Goes, and there's two other books, and they're letters from Dinah and Duff trying to keep their love affair alive, and the talking about losing all their friends, and then it goes into the Second World War as well. So you get a really unique perspective of what it was like to be a woman at home, you know, and a man who was in the war zone but not actually at the front, but who had lots of friends dying around them, you know, and they would, you know, try and write to each other to comfort each other after the loss of each one of their friends. And it was a fantastic perspective on what it was really like to live through those two world wars. I really recommend it to anyone who'd love to.
I think one of the things that had the most impact on me was Vera Brittain's Testament of Youth. Mm. And I think I saw it on television.
Yes,
first.
It was dramatised, wasn't it, some years ago?
And it was done excellently. Mm-hmm. And it was just so powerful, and it was that exactly that. Mm-hmm. Every other week, somebody else died.
She lost,
you know,
when you think about bereavement and how strong it is and how people cope with bereavement after bereavement.
I think one of the things that I'm really enjoying, is Michael McPurgo and the stuff that he's doing for children now, because I think we kind of forget, as a society, we're kind of forgetting all the things that happened in both wars.
Yes.
But I think the fact that he's writing it for children and making it, you know, making children aware of what it was like. And I mean, some of you have read Private Peaceful recently.
Yeah.
The book blew me away, and I saw a stage play, and that was the whole audience, apart from a group of ladies, were kids. Mm. And you could have heard a pin drop. Mm. You know, they were absolutely mesmerised by this guy's performance.
Wow.
You know, and just the words and everything about it, and just unbelievable. Mm. But it's making it alive for kids so that they understand. Yeah. And War Horse, you know, very similarly.
I think when we get an anniversary, obviously there's a kind of a renewed interest. And that's the whole point of the remembrance movement, is lest we forget. We have to remember all these things that happened.
Although I'm not convinced that anyone in the normal life remembering anything is going to make a blind bit of difference when it comes to the next one, if it comes to the next one.
No.
Call me a cynic.
scarily true.
It's honouring the people who've lost their lives, isn't it? That's what it's doing.
Mm. Interesting, most of the World War One poets that we're aware of are all male. But apparently a forgotten female poet of the First World War is to be honoured at Armistice, the Armistice Centenary, which is good news. She's called Mary Borden. Mm. Unfortunately, when I Googled that, I kept getting articles about Lizzie Borden. And apparently one of her poems, will form the heart of an event at the Tower of London.
It's a long time since I read All Quiet on the Western Front, but there's a very memorable image from that book that stayed with me. Obviously, it's written from a German perspective, but as the troops were travelling to the front on trains, they saw all the coffins stacked ready. This was a big administrative thing. They had to have a lot of coffins to deal with it. So they actually saw them as they were travelling to the front, or certainly in the novel.
Remember, though, the impact. I don't remember details, and I don't, because it's years and years since I've read it, but I remember it having a great impact on me. And I think, it was from the German perspective, you know, they were the enemy. But the emotion that you felt on reading it was no different.
Well, he's writing from the point of view of an ordinary soldier. He's not a politician. Yeah. The soldiers on both sides were cannon fodder. Right.
I think it was that sort of the empathy.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting to look at the logistics of mass death?
Yes.
Yeah. Because you don't think about such things as factories having to make body bags and coffins.
And being the people at the top who order these things, knowing that this is going to happen, I find that absolutely incomprehensible.
Well, that's their job, isn't it? I'm sure there are people in the army today whose job it is to work out the collateral damage.
Yes. That just reminded me of Oh, What a Lovely War.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's...
What was that?
Did you never see Oh, What a Lovely War?
I don't know. Is it a film? God.
Well, there is a film, but it's a play.
Initially a play.
Oh, What a Lovely War. It's parodying, in the style of a sort of Edwardian seaside show.
Oh, it's fabulous.
It's brilliant. Joan Littlewood. Get the film.
Okay.
Yeah. But that, the idea that these people at the top, you know, just sat in their offices just distributed, you know, thousands and thousands of people who were all going to die. And,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, just a percentage of them. Yeah, mm-hmm. It was just so casual in a sense, wasn't it? Yeah. And that was part of
it. I don't believe it was casual. I think it's when we look back, it seems casual, but, you know, the people at the time were fighting for very real things that they believed needed to be fought for. And that's the tragedy of war, isn't it?
Yes.
When we look back, we see the futility and the tragedy. Mm. You know, my grandfather lied about his age to join the Navy when he was 15 because he wanted to go off and be part of that great adventure.
My dad did.
Yeah.
And he got kicked out and still waited and joined the Army when he was 16.
I'd just like to talk about memoirs as well,
because
it's not fictionalised, but the, if you like, the memoirs that came out of the First World War, that was a whole new raft of memoir work, which was really quite famous things even now. So we had Winged Warfare in 1918 by William Bishop, Flying Fury by James McCudden, and The Red Fighter Pilot by Manfred von Richthofen. The latter two men were killed in action after their books were written, and so they were, you know, they were published posthumously. But, you know, those kind of first-hand memoirs of things really do.
And of course, the Red Baron has become an almost mythical figure, although he wasn't a true historical figure. Yeah.
And I've just finished Kate Atkinson's God in Ruins. She wrote one book about someone who lived through the war years and kept reliving their life. Mm-hmm. And then she went on to write this one. I didn't really enjoy it to start with, but as it got going, it was about one of the characters in the first book, and Teddy. And he was a fighter pilot, and the book just got stronger and stronger and stronger. And it really powerfully got over to you that these kids were getting up in these planes, 19 years old on average, and going off to sorties. And before they went, the WAF ladies would tell them their statistical chances of coming home again.
Well, it was two eggs on my plate, wasn't there? If you had two eggs on your plate in the morning when you went for breakfast, if you were given two eggs, you knew you were on a dangerous mission. And somebody wrote a book called Two Eggs on My Plate or a Plate or something.
Oh, how interesting.
No, but that's fiction, you know. I just think the number of real-life memoirs that came out, when, you know, if you can bear to keep reading them, and, you know, the history that we get from those first person really accounts is amazing. Yeah. I mean, Testament of Youth was a memoir, of course. We've already mentioned that.
And interesting, because it put the sort of the woman as a sort of active participant rather than just as the sort of little wife
waiting at home.
And then, of course, there was the Vietnam War. We've had lots of literature coming out of the Vietnam War, haven't we?
A lot of it, yes. Mm-hmm. And we've had things like Catch 22.
Fantastic book.
Yes, it is. And so many others. But I want to mention, growing up in the South, in the country, as I did, after World War II, I guess I was born in 1944, so this would have been, you know, in the early 50s that I remember songs. I remember songs that were sung about the war, like, "Oh, Fraulein, Fraulein, you know, look up toward the heavens," and about a man who had fallen in love with a German woman and then, of course, had to come home, and it was unrequited, and another one called "Dear John, Oh, How I Hate to Write." Going to wed somebody else tonight. But those are the kinds of things that I can remember from that early time in my life about hearing about that. Of course, with the Vietnam War, as Stephanie says, there have been so many other things. And at that time, there was this movement, the hippie movement, the Haight-Ashbury thing, and Woodstock, and all of these resistances, you know, that were. And that was an extremely interesting time a big change in the culture.
But also the songs, you know, at Alice's Restaurant, for example, or the Jimmy Cliff song Vietnam. So the songs emerge as well in popular culture.
And Country Joe and the Fish.
Country Joe and the Fish,
War, huh? What is it good for?
Because I've dealt with a lot of older people in my career, I love listening to the stories that they used to tell about the war, and almost gave you kind of a lighter side of it. Yes, my mother-in-law used to tell the most amazing stories about the Second World War, and she had an amazing time. She loved it. She loved American airmen and used to tell all sorts of stories about going out into Wilmslow in the evening to dances and things with these gorgeous American airmen, as I say. And when she died, my daughter did a reading and said a few words about her gran. And one of the things was, you can imagine Grandma sitting there, you know, up on a cloud up there, you know, sort of eyeing up all the airmen. But I suppose in some ways humour then comes out. You've mentioned, yeah. Oh, what a lovely war. Humour became something really quite important. And to lighten things, you know, and I think some of the stories have been amazing.
And we mustn't forget, of course, that the war changed lives for women completely, because we had to step up and we were allowed, there was a space to go and get jobs and all sorts of things. So,
in the Second World War.
Yeah. My granny was a tram driver in the First World War.
Wow.
And she worked in munitions in the Second World War. Wow. But in between, she just had babies and children and grandchildren. But she did, work in both wars, and people did.
And there were an awful lot of single women after the war.
Of course. Who had to make a living for themselves.
Yeah. And a lot of aunties that, you know, weren't blood relatives, that, you know, sort of helped. Most families had an auntie or two that were either bereaved during the war, or just there was a shortage of men.
Yeah.
So there weren't enough men to go around. Yeah.
Again, to speak of my grandmother, she was married quite young and had a baby about 18 years old, and her husband died in the First World War. Her first husband died in Egypt. My grandfather was injured, so all his life he had a withered arm, but he became her second husband. So she was lucky. A lot of women didn't get even one chance, never mind two chances. Right. There certainly weren't enough men to go around after the war. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's move on to discussion of our writing lives now, shall we?
Ooh.
Everyone's looking awfully guilty.
Not me.
No, look at
for once.
Oh,
I'm being not smart.
Well, why don't you kick off, Teresa, so you can make us all feel super bad afterwards?
Well, no, because last time I hadn't done anything when we did this. But I mentioned that I'd signed up for newsletters from the website A Well Told Tale. And I got a worksheet from that source about managing your time and setting aside time and trying to do a little every day, setting targets. And I did it for about a week, and I will get back to it. You know, I've got visitors and things, so it's not happening at the moment. But I have to say, I hated doing it. I hate doing it. And I thought, I'm just going to write now for an hour or whatever. But I did, each day that I did it, produced between 600 and 700 words.
Wow.
So I have like 3,000 words that I didn't have before, and I will get back into it, but I do it kind of through gritted teeth. I don't like it. I don't like it because I want to think about it and plan my writing, and I want to know that I've got something to write and to work on. But it is, you know, if you can work the system, it can push you on a bit. So I started a new story, which I know Linda won't like, but I have. But that's what I did with that time, because I didn't feel, I'm doing research for my novel at the moment. Reading a book, in other words. Mm-hmm. But so I didn't feel I could push on with that. So I did something else that's been in a story that's been in my mind for a long time.
Well, let's clarify that it's not that I don't like your writing.
No, I know that.
It's that I chide you for going from one to another.
Absolutely, to another. I know exactly. Guilty as charged. Yeah.
So who else?
You know, speaking about how, you know, you have to force yourself to do it through gritted teeth sometimes. I think it's a problem, maybe not for everyone, but for a majority, perhaps, of writers or of us, that it's very difficult to make yourself sit down and start. And I've been going through the things that I've written over the past months, and I find such a difference in the quality of my writing when I was into it and not forced.
Yes.
And then when I'm sitting down trying to make myself write,
it's
just the trying to make myself is dry without good description.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like I struggle for the right word a lot more. And then I'm just delighted when I go back through these and find, wow, that's a great passage.
Yeah. But do you feel that then, having sort of done these, if you like, forced marches of writing, do you feel you can then go back and give them a bit of juice and colour and vibrancy?
That happens sometimes, because it's then like you have a bit of a framework.
Yeah, you're moving the plot on.
Yeah.
but it's not necessarily your greatest writing.
Or, that's right.
Yeah.
It's certainly not my greatest writing. And I look at it, and then it makes me more discouraged about making myself sit down and write, mm-hmm. because I think, well, it's not good when I do that. But if you don't, then nothing ever happens, because yes. you can't just wait for inspiration.
Wait for the muse to strike. Yeah.
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 The muse is off duty.
Yeah.
So that's where you're at, is it? Because we have had some writing retreats recently, haven't we?
Yes, we have. Yeah. And I like that, because I do get stuff done. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. When we're all together writing, somehow it makes it so much easier to do than when you're just sitting alone at home.
I don't know if it makes it easier, but we've committed the time. We've committed to spend the day together, and then we sit round and discuss what we're going to do, and then we go off for 45 minutes or an hour and write, and then we have to come back and tell the others what we've done. So again, you have to do something. Yeah, yeah. You're in that right. situation. You've made a commitment.
That's right.
You've given up the day.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
What about you, Heather? What's your writing been like recently?
One of the best things was the Litfest that we did, and one of the workshops. It was the beginning was I've never told anybody this, but and
the
then
prom.
We carried on,
mm-hmm.
and I've been struggling to find out what Mrs. Chowdhury, out in my stories, what her kind of backstory is. And it came to me because, you know, that I've written about Rose and the story. And I just couldn't find a kind of hook for Mrs. Chowdhury. And the thing is, she knew all along that Rose was looking for Mo. She knew where she was. You know, because the story, you know, the partition of India, the baby went missing, the mum spent the rest of her life trying to find them. Well, Mrs. Chowdhury knew where she was.
Oh.
And that just came to me when we were doing that. So that's given me the story, mm-hmm. and I say the hook to hang everything on about why Mrs. Chowdhury's as she is.
Fascinating that you can go to a literary festival, sit in a workshop and get an idea that just presumably has been bubbling in your subconscious.
I don't think so. I don't think I've ever thought that before.
Oh. Is somebody asking you the right question?
Yes, it was
just unlocked your creativity.
Yes, I can write about her.
Good. So you're feeling pretty good about your writing life at the moment?
Well, yeah, I've had a few weeks off with visitors, and I think, like we've all said. Mm. But I'm really pleased with that. So it's something I can do. And also something that we did in our Write Club meeting, where we had to describe a place.
Oh yes. That was a good one.
I've actually put that into the Rose story.
Oh, right.
I've actually included that in it.
Oh, yeah. Describing a place without naming the place.
Yes. And I had a good experience on the poetry course that I did, the virtual poetry course, where they asked you to think of an old master and describe what was going on in the scene as if you were in the scene without naming the old master. That was really good too. Yeah.
That's a useful exercise.
Yeah.
Well, we'll do that, won't we?
Yeah.
When we have a normal
writing.
A painting. Okay. Yes. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Steph, what have you been up to?
I've got my 8th rejection.
Way!
Ninety-two more to go.
On our retreat day, I did quite a lot of work on the plot of book number two, and I got an idea. It's pretty dark,
right?
And I need to really think about. I really, really need to think about whether I want to do it.
Whether you want to do it. I can see that. I knew you were going to say that when you said it's dark.
It's very dark. And
I can understand that. Do you want to delve into that?
How much I want to go into it. But anyway, it came to me and it's a lovely idea. And so I have got a plot together. I think I'm going to take... I've got quite a lot of things going on in my life. I've got, you know, travelling. I've got christenings. I've got things like that coming up. So I'm going to be travelling. So I'm thinking I'm going to spend a few weeks just reading. So I've got a pile of books that I'm desperate to read. I've got 2 book club books to read, which obviously they're my priority. But my Sundoku, my pile of books that I've bought that I haven't yet read, is just getting higher and higher and higher. And my poor Kindle is just bursting. So I'm going to take a few weeks off writing, I think, and just immerse myself in some reading. And I think what tends to happen with ideas, for me anyway, is that I've got things going on sort of in the background, at the back of my head. And it's almost like when programs run overnight.
Let things
render overnight, and then suddenly the finished article will pop up. And I just think that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to read.
Good.
For the next few weeks,
wow,
which will fit in with my travelling and visiting and so on, because I'm going to have lots of time on planes, trains and automobiles.
Listen and read,
so that's what I should be doing.
What about you, Pat?
Yeah, I finished a story.
Today.
So now I have to decide, and I think I have actually already decided, do I do what Stephen King says and put it in a drawer for six weeks?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe not 6 months. Or do I sort of go back on it now? And I think I probably need to leave it, let it lie for a little while.
Get that distance from it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So now I need to play around with some ideas and decide what's next.
Has anything occurred over the last few months?
A couple of things, but nothing's kind of grabbed me by the throat yet. Because I haven't really had time to think about them because of... so focused on trying to get this thing finished. So I just, it's kind of like a big weight off me. Now I can think, what shall I do now?
Yeah.
It's quite a luxury, isn't it?
Yeah.
What about you, Nicola? What have you been up to?
Well, I went to our writing retreat, which was in a beautiful garden, a really lovely environment, I thought. And, you know, there was internet and there was power and there was food. And it was everything we needed, really, wasn't it? It was lovely. Yes. And worked through, I felt very uninspired about Brianne, and I worked through one of your workshop. You were going to lead a workshop at the Literary Festival, and I worked through one of your worksheets, and I'd had an idea floating in the sea, and it enabled me to work up the whole plot of the story, which I'm really excited about. Haven't had time to sit and write the actual thing yet, but I feel very empowered going in that I've got the whole thing down from your worksheets. So really well done there, and I think everyone at the festival enjoyed them as well, didn't they?
I certainly enjoyed the one I went to.
I've had a flurry of reviews on youwriteon.com. Quite a big flurry, and I've Steph's at number 3 in the top 10 charts, and number 1 and number 2 are the same gentleman. That's been interesting. And then I've burst into the top 10 at number 23.
All right.
But the thing about... I looked at the top 10, and then I thought, I'll just skim the next 10. I thought, I must be here somewhere. I thought, I'll just keep going until I find myself. And I was at number 23, which I don't think is too bad.
No,
so the thing about You Write On is you get to remove one review every 4.
I've worked out how to do that.
Yeah, well, you're all right. You're number 3 without removing anyone. Right. But some of the reviews are a little bit ill thought out, and they've obviously given you low scores. And the thing about You Write On is every 4 you can remove one, and I've removed 3. So, but you make notes of what they've said, because obviously their opinion is valid.
Right.
But, you know, they've given you the lowest scores. So the idea is that as you polish your story, you can put it back in the newly edited version, the latest version, you can put it back in, and hopefully your scores will get higher as new people read it and give it a better score.
Right.
So I've noticed my scores are edging up a bit now, and obviously I'm removing the ones where I put it on the first time.
Can I ask you something?
Yes.
Are you number 23 in the sci-fi
genre? No, in the overall.
Yeah. That's really good.
Yeah, and the other good thing about youwriteon.com is they give you your reviews based on everyone who's read it, and then they give you your scores based on people who love your genre.
So that's an
interesting contrast. Right, so at the moment, I'm neck and neck on both at the moment. But the comments are, some of the comments have been very, very good. So, I do feel I'm...
Very helpful, aren't they?
Yes, I do feel that they've helped me enormously. I mean, obviously, I've got absolutely no adverbs or passive voice at all now. I've run it all through Hemingway. And I know you guys say not to do that, but I prefer to do... I'm an all or nothing kind of girl. I'd rather get rid of it all, the rubbish, and then come back at it. Mm. I am concerned that I can't remember where we were, but someone was saying it sounds like someone's dropped... Oh, yeah, that's right, we were in Reading Club, weren't we? Talking about Eleanor Oliphant, it's completely fine. And someone said that it sounds like she's gone back and realised she's got no descriptive passages, so she's dropped them in piecemeal. And I'm a little bit worried that that's what I'm going to do now, but... You know, it's all learning, isn't it?
And also, Sarah Bauer, who's a very brilliant writer, said she does something similar to you. She goes and she takes out all the adverbs, and then she reads it through and thinks, where do I need it? Where does the rhythm of the sentence need another word? Where is it appropriate? So, you know, although I have been a bit sniffy about using software to judge your writing or to, you know, it's interesting that somebody who I do respect and admire as a writer does something similar. She, okay. I don't know that she uses software to do it, but she'll take out all the adverbs and then go and see where she actually needs them.
I must confess, I took an adverb out of my extract only yesterday.
Well, just the one. I've been known to have five in a sentence before.
And I replaced it with a show don't tell.
Yeah, oh, very good. So I'm going to now go and read my favourite sci-fi writer, because I'm pretty convinced that he has long descriptive passages that I found most eloquent and emotive. Uh-huh. Not emotive, what's the word when you evoke a place?
Evocative.
Yes. And I'm going to inspire myself by reading some of his stuff, and then I'm going to go and write some, go through mine and think, you know, have I got any description in this chapter at all? Mm-hmm. My biggest challenge is that because I'm setting up, I think I've got perhaps too many time storylines going on. I think I need to decide who my main three protagonists are, and it's less and less
one
the...
Choose one first.
Well, see, I've gone off her.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Do you remember when we spoke to Keziah Frost? She said that she wrote a book and she had two people in it, and she thought one of them was going to be the reluctant fortune teller, and then suddenly realised it was the other one. She thought it was going to be Carlotta, and then it turned out to be Norbert. Sometimes your characters just go, sorry, you've got me all wrong.
Yeah.
And so if you've gone off her, that's fine.
Has anyone ever read the Thomas Covenant books?
No.
About leprosy.
Yes, about the guy who it's a time travelling thing,
read,
isn't it?
The trilogy.
Yeah, absolutely. And he was the most annoying. He was an anti-hero. Everybody just found him. He was just pathetic, wasn't he? I mean, so I think that's how I'm feeling a little bit about Brienne at the moment. Right. She's absolutely pathetic. She's got some flawed thinking going on, and actually, I'm more drawn to her mentor now as a hero, Rex. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, but anyway, it's evolving. It's evolving.
Yeah. Well, you say he looks like George Clooney, so
that's probably why you're drawn.
Well, that little expression has been firmly removed. I'm showing, not telling, that he looks like George Clooney.
Oh,
now.
Okay. I don't like it when people say somebody looks like somebody famous. No, what if you don't know that? Yeah. This is assumed culture, isn't there?
Yeah. And I think my writing is definitely getting better for all these learnings that I'm having, and it's early days.
And that's where I think youwriteon.com is useful, because you get people who are writers and readers, people just like us, who are there. And everybody's really there for the same reason. It's like a kind of massive write club. You know, obviously, some people are going to have different opinions and not like your stuff. Not everybody's going to. But then that's the same. If we ever get published, you know, somebody's going to go onto Goodreads or Amazon and say, that was tosh. And somebody else is going to say, that was brilliant. You know, you're never going to have everybody agreeing.
And sometimes it's amazing. I mean, I read a book recently. I didn't finish it. I thought it was dreadful. And it's had superb reviews. Reviews, and other people, this again was in a book club, not the same one that you guys are in, some people were giving this book 10 out of 10 and I was giving it 0. You know, I mean, I just thought intrigued. It was dreadful.
We'll talk about that off air.
I don't mind saying, because it's a bestseller, if I could remember the name. Oh, The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle. Very weak, in my opinion.
Really?
Absolute twaddle. But some people love it.
It's
never heard of it.
Oh,
Waterston's thriller of the month. Yeah, it's not even a thriller, in my opinion.
It's kind of Agatha Christie meets Quantum Leap meets Sherlock Holmes meets gothic horror. Just, and you know, you never really get to know the protagonist, because he keeps inhabiting other people's bodies.
Nobody has any personality in it. There are no personalities in it. I just found it dreadful, but anyway, that's my opinion.
I thought some of the phrasing of the writing was beautiful,
but some of the imagery was like he goes into a room full of women and says, their faces swam up at me from their boredom. And I just think, how am I supposed to visualise that? What does that mean? You know, and there were other things. You know, I could see the memory wrapped itself around his face. So what does this guy's face look like? I don't know.
I quite liked that. I think it was nominated for some massive prize, wasn't it? Pulitzer or something.
Pulitzer?
Yeah, no, something. It was nominated for something big.
If you go on Goodreads, it's almost all the reviews are extremely positive.
Really?
So,
The Seven Deaths of Evelyn Hardcastle. And so America, I'm out of step, I accept that.
You are entitled to your opinion. And, I'm just trying to get, as chairman, I'm just trying to get this meeting back up. Yes. I'm worried about we running over to like 2 hours or something. So it is nearly time to wrap up for this week, but before we do, there's just time for Linda and Pat to tell us what they're reading at the moment. So, Linda, what's on your bedside table?
Well, it's an interesting book. I ran into some trouble, and it's by Peggy Caserta. Peggy was the person, believe it or not, who invented the bell-bottom jeans. She had a clothing store in Haight-Ashbury, and she was a great friend of Janis Joplin's. She was truly a real wild child at the time. She made millions. She wound up in prison, and she arranged prison break for some other. She was the incredible things that have happened in her life. But it was throughout that period of the flower child and the hippie days, for better description. And I'm finding it really, really interesting.
Oh, that sounds good. I really love to read that.
Yeah,
it sounds
quite a character.
Yeah.
Great.
What about you, Pat?
Okay, I'm reading quite an interesting one, quite controversial, modern. I think it was published this year, and it's called Putney by Sofka Zinoviev. And basically, it deals with child sexual abuse, but it's not really presented as child sexual abuse. Daphne is the key protagonist. And she's 9 when we first meet her in the 70s. And she's the child of Edmund and Ellie. Edmund's a sort of academic and Ellie is a Greek lawyer who's given up her city job for activism against the dictatorship of the colonels. Mm-hmm. And it's a very sort of free sort of existence. There are no rules or routines in the family house, which is on the river in Putney. And parents, children, friends just come and go. It's all very free and easy. And Ralph is, I think, in his early 20s when we first meet him. And he's a composer and he's a friend of Edmund. And he visits often. He's collaborating with Edmund on kind of operas, I think, musical pieces. And he is just completely obsessed with Daphne. And they form a friendship, and then when she, well, even before she's 13, really, it becomes sexual. And then eventually, but she never feels that she's been abused. She never accepts that there was anything wrong in it. There's no violence or pain for Daphne. She believes for decades afterwards that she was quite knowing, consenting and unharmed. I'm right at the beginning of the story. But there are hints because it goes backwards and forwards in time, and she has had problems with drugs and addiction and so on, and failed marriages. But it's interesting. Mm, and the timing, the place, it switches between Putney and Athens and the island of Aegina, and the descriptions are fabulous. The places are really well realised. Mm.
Good stuff. Well, that's the end of Write Club, the podcast for this week. We hope you've enjoyed the show. But don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher so every new show is automatically delivered wherever you want it. And please take a few minutes to leave us a review if you can. So until next week.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.